Hey, welcome back to another episode of Inside the Mind. I am your host, Mizbah Honk. And before we dive into today's episode, I just wanted to say a quick thank you to our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Pod Mahal. They help people who have a purpose, they have something they want to share, something they want to say, and they want to profit, but they want to do it without the perfectionism. So getting started on creating content for your business has never been easier. You literally show up, you speak your ideas into existence, and they take care of the rest. They are able to authentically preserve your voice and translate that into Instagram posts or your own podcast on Apple and Spotify or YouTube videos if that's your thing. So check them out at podmahal.com. And if you want to start a project, tell them we sent you. Email hi@podmahal.com. Thanks so much for supporting the show. And without further ado, enjoy today's episode. Noah, thank you so much for coming on here today. You are someone who is involved heavily in the mathematics and physics world and also finance. And so I always find it interesting where, you know, people find creativity in fields that have a sense of like, okay, that's just, it's black and white, right? Zeros and ones, math. What creativity could there be in this field? But often with anything, like when you dig deep enough, there is an art to, you know, even the most boring of subjects. And so I'm excited to kind of hear some of your background and journey in this world. I mean, you're up to a lot of cool stuff today, right? But like, take us back. What was, how'd you kind of get involved in this world? Were you somebody who just excelled or was drawn to it at a young age?
I've always been, pretty proficient with reasoning. I'm of an age where they were still giving IQ tests to you know, basically all children as part of the assessment to kind of figure out how to track through. And I essentially nailed the fluid reasoning section, which is kind of the how good you are at logic part of that test. And I've been pretty much knocking those out of the park ever since. I think I got like one wrong on that section of the GRE, which is pretty embarrassing, but I'm really, really bad at clerical speed and accuracy. So, I've got a little bit of a dyslexia and I, you know, kind of one bubble filled in wrong out of 200 questions is actually a little, that's a little good for me. I usually average a little worse than that, when I'm into those things.
Well, what is it about that world, I guess, or that process that brought you to be like, oh, I should double down here? Because I'm sure you had a moment where you were like, this is working, or I'm, you know, maybe it was after the test, before the test, but what made you go, this is something I want to dedicate a lot of my time and energy into for a long time to come, hopefully?
It was basically, just ease of opportunity. I've never been that physically robust. I'm really prone to heat stroke, for example. In fact, well, I can sweat when I work out. If it's too hot, I just stop sweating and then, you know, pretty swiftly stop doing everything else as well.
Right.
Sort of pathing towards not working with my brain, was never really seemed realistic. And I don't write very well either. My brain sort of shuts down in the face of creating permanent media. But I did develop some capacity to have conversations, and I've got a great memory and I've got this sort of logical facility. So I just kind of canaled down that road. In college, I wound up studying nuclear engineering, largely because of how broad it was.
Wow.
Nuclear engineering brings civil engineering, mechanical engineering, along with nuclear physics all together in this one package. And you just get to learn a whole bunch of fascinating things. And energy production is a vital part of society. There's a very direct correlation between how much energy is available and how wealthy a society is. And one of the most dramatic demonstrations of this, if you've seen that night sky map where they've got the map of the world, but it's all lit up bright in some places and then totally dark in others. Well, there's, you know, the UN releases, you know, demographic maps. And if you look at a map of, you know, per capita incomes or life expectancies or any of the other sort of wealth correlates, all those maps are the same as each other. And they're all the same as the night sky map. You just, you know, the what makes people wealthy is having more energy to live their lives. And what makes people poor is having to physically do everything themselves.
That's fascinating.
The world has moved into sort of the digital space.
Yeah.
Computers are ever more important. But I contend that energy is still important. What computers provide is an entirely new way to use that energy, whereas the mechanical breakthroughs of the last, say, four centuries made it cheaper to do physical labor with a machine than it was to do it with a person, if you could figure out how to build that machine. Since computers are control or decision engines, what they ultimately allow is potentially making it cheaper to do a job with a computer than with a human, but that job would be sort of a kind of service, you know, expertise type of a job. And we can already see this, for example, with translation, where, you know, my browser has a machine translation button on it. In head-to-head competition, regularly outpaces human capacity. There have been some studies suggesting that medical diagnosis could actually be improved, although there's some major barriers to commercialization of that kind of technology, some of which are that it's explicitly unpatentable. So if you were to make any strides in that realm, you would not be able to have any patent protection around what you were doing. But in theory, we're either just over or really close to the line of where we would have sufficient computer technology that we could do diagnostician actions better through computer mediation than sort of the family doctor. What my project is working on is a way to create financial markets that obviate most of the roles of existing financial professionals and just focus down on the ones that have a information service that's still actually valuable within that market.
Wow, that's pretty fascinating. I do wonder about that a lot, like that translator example that you gave, or even the doctor. I mean, the doctor example is another thing, right? Where it's like, okay, doctors could be replaced, but they can't be replaced. The translator is a more real look at like, oh man, that's so true. Like I can go on Google Translate and, you know, that eliminates the need for a lot of people who maybe spent their lives doing that. What's the solution there? Or is there still a need, do you think, for that human element, no matter if our browser is still able to do that? You know, I don't know if there's an answer to that, but I'm curious because you've thought about this a lot.
Well, in the case of translation, and in the case of many things that we're sort of getting first cracks at, the technology is leaning upon a society that already has these capacities that's being used in a way that is, say, fundamentally honest. Unfortunately, the introduction of that technology not only undermines the existence of that society, but also creates a incentive for fundamental dishonesty, which undermines the algorithm itself. So I was explaining this to somebody earlier, the way the algorithm works at sort of a very baseline is that records of, say, every from any two languages, you know, French and Polish, every every two documents that exist in French and Polish translation that are available, which is effectively every such pair of documents that sort of currently exists, are sort of cross-indexed with each other and stored in a big pile. And so when you want to know what a word means, say we, I can't really quote any Polish, but I know one or two French words. What you would do is you'd search through the French pile and find every single instance of that word in the French pile. And then you would get the corresponding Polish pile, look at what the correlates were in the Polish pile. So this word means something. It has to appear in all of these documents because it's getting translated. What appears in all of these documents, you know, because this word is here? Well, that's whatever the Polish word for the French word we is. That depends on a large corpus of honestly translated documents. But if I've got this automatic translator, I can create honestly translated documents all day long. But those documents don't actually help out very much. But here's where things get crazy. I could dishonestly translate documents. What if I wanted, you know, French tourists to come into my tourist trap in Poland? I could basically dishonestly associate documents where the name of my tourist trap was associated with names of superlatives in French. And suddenly, like, the name of my tourist trap, like, translates as exactly what you're looking for, no matter what you're looking for, and polluting the system of translated documents, which would be incredibly expensive and something that academics would have to do, and that would ruin their own, you know, reputations, but is now something that I could have a computer just crank out trillions of.
Right.
You know, I could rent some from Jeff Bezos and just have him do that for me. Suddenly becomes this option. And if that were to happen, then the value of these translations would degrade. So the way we do things right now, we're opening up these new capacities, but what we're also doing is opening up these new opportunities for entirely new kinds of attacks on society at large. Whereas when we were sort of keeping expertise inside of human beings, a person would destroy their own reputation to perform one of these attacks. And society sort of doesn't need any given individual because, you know, if it does, then people are mortal, they die. And then if the society needed that person, then it dies too. So we have these new opportunities. We also have these new challenges. We really don't think about these things in public in any productive way that I've seen. But it very much looks to me like while we have other problems as well, these challenges seem to underlie or directly represent major issues that are actually driving crises on a regular basis. And therefore worth study and solution if possible.
Right, because it's like if tech kind of works at scale, then any error you have is also going to be scaled. And, you know, obviously you're doing your best to mitigate that, but you want to, I guess, protect your data. Well, so before I kind of move along, there's something you said that really stood out to me around computers and tech are responsible for, like, they're like control or decision machines. And that was interesting because it's like, well, if tech and computers and all that stuff are in charge and you can help, you know, leverage them to make control or decisions, then what is it that humans can leverage to, like, as a let's keep rolling with the translator concept here, like, the idea there for somebody who is a translator, a Polish or French, and now it's like the one plugin has taken over maybe the whole browser and eliminated a need for maybe them to translate your web pages or something to this language. Would you say that the safe solution, the smart solution, the inevitable one probably is that you pivot and you're like, all right, I'm not a translator anymore, but I'm going to use my skills of translating to this other area. Or I'm going to build my own version of this that, you know, maybe people could use. I don't know if there's an answer, but what is the out for people who are in a field where it feels like it's going extinct, if not already?
On an individual basis, that's a productive approach. It's certainly the one I would encourage. It's certainly not the only approach. This happened, in the Industrial Revolution, large numbers of jobs stopped happening. One of the conservative objections to the Industrial Revolution was that people were moving off the farms, that, you know, it used to be that 80% of people lived rurally and essentially did farm work for a living. And so in the, say, early 1700s, gotcha, the social thinkers were saying this, you know, citification, urbanization was very concerning because, you know, we all eat food. 80% of people work their entire lives making food. Clearly, if 60% of, you know, all people spend their entire lives making food, then total food reduced by 25%, a quarter of all people are going to die. Now, right, you know, in this country, something like 2% of people make all of the food, because machines have allowed them to become radically more productive. And that's why people can live in cities. But there was an uneven progress along the way of figuring out what was going on. Some people moved to cities and completely lost their minds. Some people moved to cities and did very well. Some people, you know, set up rebellions and destroyed things. And some of those people did very, yeah, well too. If they, you know, if the rebellion was successful and they took over a country or a county or something. I see this as the foundational problem of our time, is that right now it's pretty fringe. You know, people like chess masters and translators, who are people that I'd say most human beings don't actually encounter one in the course of their lives, or, you know, would only sort of collaterally know one, or maybe friend of a friend type of a thing. It's not doctors and lawyers, mm-hmm, and, you know, mayors and police officers yet, but it's very easy to see how it could be those sorts of things, just as it's very easy to, yeah, see how it could be judges or legislatures or even sort of lower skill clerk type, secretarial type positions are getting swiftly moved into these sorts of spaces. And so that's a real challenge. One of the issues that I think about, since I'm proposing this thing that would essentially shift the financial system, is the people who used to work for the financial system but are no longer useful within my system, what future is available for them? And I think to myself, well, these people are very wealthy and very savvy human beings, so I feel that they would have a relatively easy time pivoting. You know, if you're a sort of successful day trader that's managing tens of millions of dollars or more, I feel like you have a personal network and a personal net worth and some kind of skill set that would allow you to find something else to do with your life if what you were doing right now just didn't exist. But yeah, it's a very different thing if you're doing that even to highly educated, highly intelligent people who have just gotten out of college and have, you know, $200,000 of student debt, which if you're like a, right, 16 language translator, maybe that's who you are.
Yeah. It's one of those situations, like when you look at a rocket lawyer or something like that, that has taken a very high billable, like you needed to have an in-person attorney or something like that for the longest time. And people spend hundreds of thousands of dollars getting, you know, the credentials to be able to practice law. And then you've got something like, you know, rocket lawyer that doesn't solve all the issues. Like if you're in trouble, it's, you know, Rocket Lawyer isn't maybe going to represent you, but it can help you file an LLC. It can help you come up with a privacy policy. And there's these things where now you see lawyers who I've seen are, okay, there are some who are still in the traditional path. They have this personal network. They play, you know, they're playing the game as everybody is. And then you've got kind of the ones who are like, oh, they're making their own version of that Rocket Lawyer, where it's like, oh, you can, instead of paying me a retainer and coming into my office and all this stuff, it's like, okay, it's a little bit more accessible for you, but you're getting access to all my law. Like, I'll provide this document for you and I'll do this for you. And it's very interesting to see how it's forcing some creativity, you know, within a certain segment of an industry. But then you do have maybe the traditional side of it, where the people who don't have the three things you mentioned, like the personal network or the all the stuff, the moat kind of built around you to be able to maybe pivot and do something else with your life. It's like,
yeah,
if you're a lawyer,
I would
just
say,
spent 7 years, you know, getting spent passing the bar.
I would say those people are essentially in the buggy whip business. This is something my grandfather used to like to talk about, is that when Henry Ford started Ford Motor Company, there was something called the Selden patent, which was actually owned by a consortium of buggy whip manufacturers that they contended meant that nobody could build a car inside the United States. And Ford took it up to the Supreme Court and basically said, no, that is not in fact what the patent says. But ultimately, there was sort of only one buggy whip manufacturer left, and then, you know, they went out of business, and the last one in was the best of the bunch. But it's, if you're in a declining market share, you know, you can be the captain of the ship that's going down, or maybe you can be one of the poor bastards in the engine room in a ship that's going down, but you cannot save the ship. Like,
right.
It's going down. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's a very, like, harsh reality of it, I guess.
But we're in a position where the upper echelons of our society in terms of wealth, fame, and power are dominated by people who are in these positions which don't have futures. And so that's a very confusing time, because ambitious people are going to ape the behaviors of successful people. That's like how culture works. But if it's, you know, it's like the closing days of the royals in Europe, getting into Henry the 14th's court was a really good career move. Getting into Henry the 16th's court, or Louis the 14th's court was a good career move. Louis the 16th
right.
court was a pretty bad career move. But people did it. Like, you know, the day before Bastille Day, there was some hard-charging courtier that just had finally gotten permission to go to Versailles for the first time. You know, I'm sure that's true. And if it wasn't that day, it was the day before. And
right.
that, you know, he would have been way better off running into the countryside the week before.
It's so funny, right? Sometimes, like, by the time, like, you're so excited about something, and by the time that it comes, when it's not as, like, valuable, or like you said, it's a declining market share, like, you're in this thing of, like, oh, I just got here. You know what I mean? And you want to figure it out. And I do see what you're saying there with, like, you have this, people who are ambitious will probably figure out a way, repurpose it, and turn it into something, but it creates more and more and more of a gap than there already is between, like you said, the people in the engine room who just got the credentials, just are fresh out of college or whatever, and like, you're in a confusing time. You're like, all right, what did I just do that for? So what you were saying, your system is designed to kind of like shift how the financial system kind of works, right? How does that even begin to look like? And I'm sure it takes some of these things into account. To somebody like me, how could you kind of explain what it is that you're working on and how it might help or impact
sure,
in some
sure.
way, you know, people who are in these markets.
The first thing to understand is that financial industry is an information industry. To the extent that they're providing services which are valuable. And some of the services they provide are actually valuable in general to society. That service is disseminating true knowledge about value. And that is what allows individuals to make their own individual assessments. If the price of wheat's going up, maybe your bakery makes more oatmeal cookies. If the price of oats are going up, maybe they make more bread. Those sorts of decisions. The better and better in terms of sort of truth plus widespread dissemination, information that individuals have within an economy, the more effectively that economy can function, because individual businesses can be run more economically, the better your information is. If you are operating a taxi service on the assumption that gas was going to be $3.50 a gallon until your retirement in the mid-2000s sometime, then you're not doing too well right now. but if you knew that this was on the horizon,
right,
you could mitigate. The thing that's important about that is that the information that we're talking about here is resident, although in a very scattered and relatively noisy way, across us. Like, individual people know what their value or cost propositions are for these various things. If you make corn or mine coal or dig, you know, drill for oil or dig copper or whatever, you've got a pretty decent idea of what your unit economics looks like. And if you use any of this stuff, you've got a pretty good idea of what your value proposition looks like. So what the existing markets do is basically try to force these people to come together in an agreement to trade, just in one-on-one trades. The tricky bit is that these edge users essentially can't absorb the risk of getting it wrong. So if you've ever seen penguins about to dive into the water, they all crowd up against the edge. Well, that's because they're basically looking for predators. That guy that gets pushed off, they're checking to see whether or not something eats him. And if something does, then they don't get in the water. So what happens within these markets,
little litmus test.
Yes, is that there's this group of people that have enough money to absorb that central risk, and they more or less negotiate that center. And the riskier the marketplace is, the sort of wider that center gets, because the riskier the marketplace is, the further away the edge people kind of stop to check where things are going to get to.
Right. Okay. And then how does this impact the ever, like someone like me and you, right? To where,
so this
it does inform
this
like where we're getting
our
information
in two
from.
Places. The first one is higher costs. There was some people who about a decade ago figured out a scam in the aluminum market, which essentially jacked up the price of aluminum by something in the neighborhood of 40 or 50%. So if you bought any aluminum products back then, something like a third of what you paid for that product wound up in the pockets of these guys that had worked out a scam of how to up-risk the aluminum market. At the more severe end, we see supply chain disruption like we're seeing right now, and which we expect to be seeing. One of the issues with destruction of the Ukrainian wheat is that ideally we would like to see the global wheat stock production increase to sort of compensate for the fact that 8% of the wheat that used to be produced won't be produced this year. The two countries with sort of the biggest slack in wheat production are Canada and the United States. We aren't increasing our wheat production this year because the system that we have stabilizes the price at the production end, which means that the farmers aren't actually participating in this increase in wheat price. And the farmers are not going to increase their land under cultivation until they actually see prices increase. We'll see sort of a protraction of this issue because the middlemen are going to be able to eat up at least the first round of this windfall. And who knows how much more of the windfall. They'll try to get as much as they can. Those are the things that impact us sort of day to day out of this kind of issue.
Right. It's kind of like when you heard during, I don't know, it's 2020, 2021, where the chicken was almost like, it was after the toilet paper shortage and the, you know, paper towels were coming next. And it was like, oh man, we're not going to have enough chicken because like the supply chain issue, like it was just something you didn't honestly think about for a couple decades. Like there was a period of time where this was like supply chain issues were very common, right? And then it just became like, oh, we figured it out, and it felt like it was going to be figured out forever.
Yeah. Well, figuring things out forever isn't really the way things work, unless you've managed to produce a mathematical proof,
right?
Or something like that. Yeah, and in many cases,
yeah, it got outdated real quick.
Right. In many cases, what we essentially did was improve efficiencies by increasing fragility. So the assumption was that since the world's at peace, we don't need to worry about, you know, like what happens if the U.S. and the Soviets start like throwing missiles at each other. So we can design around big things, all eggs in one basket. Those types of systems, as we saw with the Suez Canal, you know, this big boat gets lodged in the thing, and suddenly the entire world's on fire because not only does that one boat have more stuff in it than like a city does, but there's a whole line of boats that big, you know, trying to come through in both directions that can't for a week, and now everybody's just in time, you know, factories all have to turn off because they don't have any parts. The shipment was supposed to come in, and then the shipment was supposed to come out. You don't get your car when you think you're gonna.
Right. Oh, Jesus. So, and do you see this, I mean, being exacerbated as time goes on, or is this something that you think we'll get a handle on again? Because we're experiencing a lot of it right now, you know, where you're like, okay, we got to figure out how so that this doesn't happen again.
This is a solve or die problem. We will either work out and adopt systems that are capable of weathering crises, or civilization will disintegrate as food, energy, shelter, and other supply shocks roll through. You know, rolling blackouts, well, rolling everything outs, basically. You know, we're having the baby formula shortage right now, and several major networks have announced that rolling blackouts are a strong probability this summer. But why wouldn't there just be more? And
now,
more
when you say rolling blackouts, what does that mean? Are you talking like electrical and internet and everything?
So I'm mostly talking electrical, but this is a strategy in California. They have very high energy demands during the summer, and they also have a forest fire problem where high energy demand power line sparking can cause forest fires. The PG&E balances the demands for power versus forest fire risk and essentially, you know, turns the crank down so that they don't set the state on fire. That's not the best possible response to that solution. But if you're in a crappy situation, sometimes you only have crappy choices. And so they've announced that they expect this summer to see rolling blackouts again. That's one pretty severe supply chain issue. But in an environment where more and more markets are actually failing to deliver useful and true information, because the stress is being placed on those markets by the communication and computer technology we've now developed exceed their capacity to function. People rely on their senses to tell them about the universe around them so that they can, you know, walk around without stubbing their toes or falling into holes. If your wiring gets messed up and you can't see what's around you, you start walking into things. And if you're in a dangerous environment, that's really dangerous. We have these systems to tell us true facts about the universe that are losing the capacity to do that. And we have built our societies on the proposition that the information they deliver are true facts about the universe, at the same time when it's obvious that that's not the case. When the foundation of something crumbles, what happens to that thing?
Yeah, I heard this concept from a scientist once that was like, you can, like, your limitation in what you can track and measure is by the technology that's available to you at that time, right? So it's just the same way, like, you couldn't track certain types of doping and cheating and sports 30 years ago, and then it's like, oh, all of a sudden you can go back 50 years and test the same, you know, thing that somebody used. And that is an example of something that has massively shifted in the course of whatever, 10 years, 5 years, and it continues to do so at that rate. I mean, this might be, I don't want this to be like super heavy, but how fast could this happen if you think about it, right? Where the supply chains issue, the blackouts, the, the collapse or decline of some of these things, the solver, I think that you were talking about, if we don't solve it, how quickly is it? A couple years at this point? Is it 10 years, 50 years? I don't know. It does seem like it could happen very, very quickly.
So,
based on what we saw in the past couple years.
If things were to crack, they could propagate extraordinarily quickly. Whether or not things will crack and whether or not we'll just be able to have a decline is very much an open question. But one example I like to point out is that pretty much until Attila the Hun rolled through and burned Rome to the ground, you would have been able to find people in Rome, in spite of the fact that the population of the city had declined by 99%. In spite of the fact that France, Germany, England, Switzerland were no longer, Sicily was no longer part of the empire. In spite of anything that you could imagine, they would maintain that Rome, the eternal city, was still the jewel of humanity and the ruler of the greatest empire that could ever exist. And that would be centuries after,
right,
after the Caesars. So human beings have a capacity to sort of do this to ourselves, to say, oh, we don't really rule Caledonia. Well, who cares? Like, that's way the hell out there, and it's cold, and the Scots are, you know, blue-painted barbarians. We didn't want it anyway. It's very easy, and it will be very easy for the people in leadership positions to regard failure as, oh, just a thing that happens. You know, this doesn't have anything to do with me. This doesn't have to do with my kids. This doesn't have to do with the future. Like, this is just, that's just an event and I didn't care about it. And so it doesn't matter which way the cookie crumbled. On the other hand, the systems that we have are centered around an industrial economy. And we don't have one of those anymore. We now have this computer information economy. We have new capacities. The challenge, therefore, is discovering what values and habits are required of us to utilize these capacities in ways that are productive and not destructive. That challenge, to bring us back to the beginning, that challenge is a mathematical challenge, because the capacities themselves are mathematical. Computers are
right,
basically math machines.
That's what I was going to say, is like, that's why I asked you, is because of the math mind, like, there is a number that if you were to statistically be like, okay, more blackouts, more brownouts, more formula shortage, more this, more that, and if it keeps going, you could foresee, just like you could predict the weather out 6 months out, like, this is a very possible event. It's funny, like, the Rome example you said, you're right. It's like, down to the very last moment, you're still kind of in this delusion of like, oh, we're the best, like, things are going to work out. And you hope you do. I'm sure that you did hope for that. But like, it's kind of,
I don't know. It takes you back to just like a survival movie where like the zombies came and the aliens took over, and it's like, oh, like life as we knew it is over, you know, and now it's like, it's a whole new age. It's not, it's like reversing from computer information age to like back to the Stone Age in a sense or something, you know. I don't know if it'd be that drastic, but
I would say a dark age is one of the two possibilities. We either come up with a modus vivendi that allows us to use this technology, and if we do, then based on how cool the toys we presently have are, I would assume that would be a much higher level of wealth than human beings have heretofore experienced, which sounds great to me. But if we can't, then we've already reached the point where our economic and political and social systems can't produce things that are productive. We have an association between teen suicide and like social network use. Our political systems are basically mired in like Twitter warfare, and can't really think intelligently about the risks and trade-offs of communication networks. Like, you know, in this country, we've got freedom of speech, and that's largely allowed the tech giants to be unregulated. But as I was pointing out with the example from translation, there's an entirely new scale of attack possibility around information dissemination in a way that never existed before maybe a decade ago. And we know that political systems are really, really bad at regulating information systems. So we have, on the one hand, this absolute need to have trustable information systems. On the other hand, we have this absolutely failed mode of managing risks. How do you square that circle? And then we have these economic systems that are being stretched far beyond their breaking point, have been becoming increasingly unstable since the 80s, since the introduction of computational technology in the first place. And again, you know, what's a society that doesn't have an economy, a government, or a culture look like?
It's especially now that you're seeing also, right, like it's the internet is one way here in the US, right? But then in China or in Russia or something, totally different. Totally. It's like a whole nother world almost, especially now. And that's just the beginning of it, right? Where it's like, hey, we're closing off our internet. You guys are in your own side of the web and we're on over on this side. I mean, that's kind of a crazy concept too, because you never, you did think it was coming one day where you're like, this is going to be regulated or something's going to happen to the internet. And maybe it's not fully here yet, but there is something you're beginning to see in just how other countries are able to regulate that is scary. And even if it doesn't directly affect us, like it is, I don't know, it does in some way where you're like, it's a model, right? You're watching a model for how a whole piece of the earth can kind of like break off into its own planet. And how heavily, you're right, like, I think this year, past couple of years, it's more, I don't know, like it's more apparent than ever to everyone that we're all headline readers and we are influenced by a quick, you can't unsee a headline, right? You can't we're not emotionally strong enough, most of us, to like bat away every headline and judge it and be like, is this true? Is this not? It's kind of just like you take it in, you take it in, you take it in. And that's where I think the problem that you're talking about happens, where it's so easy to shift the perception of a stock or a person or a place, anything, with dishonest media, in a sense. So I don't know. It is scary to think about. It's also kind of one of those things where you talked about social networks and you know, the effects that it's having on people who just grew up with it that never had a chance to live without it. How do you escape that, I guess, in the future when it seems so like, oh man, I don't exist if I don't have an Instagram or a LinkedIn, or I seem like the guy who's preparing for the apocalypse 20 years too early. You know what I mean? It's like, how do you survive and continue to live a normal life? Does it come to a point where we go, hey, screw it. We've had enough of social media. I get it. I get how annoying it is and how terrible it is for me. I'm off, you know, I'm off the grid, and it becomes more acceptable to do that. Or is it like we all keep, you know, drinking the poison and hope we survive?
Well, as somebody that isn't on social media, I hope that first thing eventually happens and some more people sort of join my bunkered up area. I really don't know. I mean, I have a probable solution to the economic problem, and I'm trying to get that up and adopted. I can mathematically formulate the cultural and political issues, and I can like run through the checklist of potential solutions to determine whether or not they sort of hit their marks and are internally consistent. If anybody wants to propose anything, nothing in the public sphere is fit for purpose. Like, I can tell you that because I've seen the public sphere. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing in there that's fit for purpose. But yeah, I mean, I'm bright and I got lucky and I tripped over this. Maybe I'll come up with some other solutions, but much more likely a lot of us are going to have to be thinking about this kind of stuff. And hopefully enough of us will get lucky to trip over some stuff that will get us through this thing.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think just alone, like what I said, just acknowledging that, like, oh, I am also a headline reader, even though I don't want to be, maybe sometimes. And so you're just more aware of that. And so over time, the more you're aware of it, you see it, you're like, okay, maybe this isn't, there is, take what you see with a grain of salt versus like the behavior and, you know, just how people consumed media 30 years ago was like, whatever you heard was fact. It was just, that was the news source. That was the one source of information you were getting things from. So maybe it's like this massive onslaught of stuff that's coming at us forces you to be a somewhat more intelligent, you know, with this.
I think that healthy skepticism you're talking about is good, caution you to be aware that mistrust, which is kind of necessary in our world, detracts from the capacity of this self-organized working together, which is very much a part of what has built up the wealth and capacity that presently exists. We need systems to be trustable, and that's where I contend that building that into the system on the basis, and my approach of measuring information content, what my system does is it measures the information content of people's contributing forecasts and then classifies that into useful and worthless, essentially forecasts that move the needle towards where the needle eventually winds up and gets used are useful. Forecasts that move the needle away from there are worthless. And so we reward based on the amount of usefulness that you put into the system. And we essentially charge for the amount of information that you attempt to put in the system. So if you put mostly or all worthless information into the system, then you're basically paying somebody to fix your mistakes for you or for everyone else. And if you put mostly valuable information in the system, then you earn a very high rate of return. And so those sorts of things,
yeah,
I think are a possibility. How something like that translates into other realms, or if that's even the right approach for those realms, I couldn't say, but a greater focus on trustability seems to be the core of anything that could be a part of a functioning information system.
No, that's really fascinating. I'm glad you pointed that out because it's like a paradox, right? You're like, okay, there is this mistrust. It's good to have the healthy skepticism, but then it's like, it's so counterproductive to the other part of it that you need to make it work and to keep going and not just be a, you know, paranoid pessimist all the time, I guess. But I'm curious for you, someone who isn't on social or, you know, on those networks, like, you know, you're here on a podcast today. You mentioned permanent media as something like, you maybe don't partake in as much and things like that, but conversations, you know, you're able to have. And I'm curious what made podcasting as a medium for you something that was like, oh, let's use this to share and discuss these ideas versus like the other million forms of putting your ideas out that you could. I mean, you don't strike me as maybe the, like, I'm going to go Instagram reel all my information, but like, you know, that option was available to you as well. What made you choose podcasting, I guess, over all that?
Mostly the conversational nature. I just felt it would be easier and more productive to produce content conversationally than it would be through monologue or written, both of which didn't strike me as terribly mm-hmm. practical. So, you know, I do have a website that's got a pile of crap on it that describes all about this stuff. You know, there's a white paper. You can go read the integral equations and figure out exactly how this works if you want to. But in order to increase my footprint and sort of create more awareness, I felt like I should be generating more content. And this was a natural fit again. It's kind of who I am. I kind of go with what's close, convenient, easy, as my first go-to.
Well, I think that's something we can learn from, right? I mean, if we all did that, I think if there's a little bit less friction we'd all be dealing with. It's like, what can you lean into that fits with your, like, you having the awareness, like, oh, I'm not a writer, don't like doing it, but like, I could talk. That saves you so much time just making that decision, being like, all right, let's try it this way. But yeah, that world in of itself of creating content, needing to do some of that nowadays to increase your footprint, but then also the other flip side that we just spent the whole hour talking about of what comes with contributing to that system and whatnot. So yeah, somebody like yourself who's thought a lot about this, I found it fascinating that it shows me that there's something to podcasting, when someone like yourself who vets platforms as like, is this worth it? Is this not? Is this worthless or useful? So very cool that you, yeah, thanks for taking the time to, you know, spend and share all your knowledge with us today.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for having me. This was a great conversation, and you know, I hope this gets out there. If it tickles somebody and they take off and they want to work on the next phase of the human economy, that would be terrific. And otherwise, you know, I'll probably get a transcription of this and add it to my sort of content, you know, pile and kind of see what I can do with this to try to get that message out to somebody that does want to do that.
100%. 100%. I love what you're doing. I really appreciate, just the, I don't know, intellect and thoughtfulness you brought to today. Where can we kind of keep up with what you're up to? You mentioned you have a website and all that. What is that for people who are listening? And also make sure to link it up in the description.
Yeah, sure. So the website is, corddisc.com. That's CORDISC. Coordinated Discovery. I say I'm not on social media, but I am on LinkedIn. I'm Noah Healy on LinkedIn. I'm the oldest Noah Healy according to Google. So most of the Noah Healys are me out there on the internet.
That's an advantage there.
That's right. Yeah. For a while, I was the only Noah Healy. But
awesome, man. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. This was really fun, and I'll be in touch. And yeah, thank you so much once again, and I'll talk to you soon.
Great.